Okay, we're live.
Ready? Hopefully this will be the last time you hear this, but good morning, everybody. I think we've heard that quite a few times already this morning. Thank you all for being here. We really appreciate it. And I want to show my appreciation to our panelists for taking the time and sharing their expertise with us. Hopefully you can see in the program their resumes and what they've done in the past. If you don't know, this is the alternative markets for accessing healthy foods. First, we're going to start with Paul Bello, who is from Hill and Holler Farm, followed by Will Oldhorn from F. Scott's Restaurant, and then Tallahassee May from Turnbull Creek Farm. Each of them will speak for about 10 minutes, talking about stories and how their adventures in, you know, supplying food to a lot of different people in a lot of different manners. Afterwards, please remember, you were told that you have blank paper in your program to write your questions. So write it down so you remember your questions. So after these three finish with their sharing their expertise, you can ask questions. The questions we want is, you know, general. We don't want specifics on how do you make lobster bisque or grow carrots. We're looking for kind of wide-ranging questions on, you know, accessing healthy foods. I guess with that, we'll just go ahead and start with Paul. So, Paul, you're on.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you.
Can I just stand this way? Is that loud enough?
It's better the other way. Okay. Go with the mic.
Okay. So, Rob and I operate Hill and Hollow CSA. So I. I was going to give a little discussion about what CSAs are, because that's my narrow window of expertise, is our particular farm. I wanted to read a definition of CSA that I got from a book by Trowder Groh, who's an early founder of the CSA movement. What is a CSA? A concept describing a community-based organization of producers and consumers. The consumers agree to provide direct, upfront support for the growers who will produce their food. The growers agree to do their best to provide a sufficient quantity and quality of food to meet the needs and expectations of consumers. There is no specific formula to this relationship. So there you have it. CSA is a model of a relationship between consumers and producers. And I think the really important part of it is, how did this start? This sort of concept was started by homemakers in Japan in the 60s that were seeking milk. Apparently, they were unsatisfied with the access they had to foods, and so they actually sought out farmers to produce milk for them. That idea caught on in Europe and then was brought to the United States, in the 70s. And here, again, it's mostly a consumer-driven movement where consumers sort of unsatisfied with the food options they had. And I'd say mostly the quality. I mean, it seems like there's plenty of food available, but I'd more say this movement's about a quality of food that attracts people to it. And so what you have is people seeking producers to produce the food. What's important about this is how this helps farmers is most of your farming has gotten sort of large and commodity-based. And when you sell things to second and third-hand persons, the price you receive as a farmer is very low. And so in this direct relationship, when you are providing food directly to consumers, you, the farmer, get 100% of that income from those things. And that's sort of the critical aspect of CSAs, is we're, instead of having gigantic farms that we run with gigantic pieces of equipment that are very expensive and being in debt, we actually can have a highly efficient small farm and make a living feeding 75 families. So that's not a huge amount of people. I mean, our farm operation survives. You know, we're doing well feeding 75 families, and so that's a very nice sort of intimate relationship that we have. CSAs arrange themselves in 1,000 different ways. You arrange a meeting point at some day of the week. Either consumers come to a farm to pick up food, or farmers deliver to various sites around a city or a town. In our case, Robin and I opted to set up at the Nashville Farmers Market because that's where we personally felt like we wanted to be. When we leave our farm, which is where we're sort of alone and very busy, we wanted to come to a place that was full of action and full of life, and also to shop for things. I mean, our farm produces mostly vegetables and meats and things, and we need things like ginger and spices and the other foods, olive oil, that are in our life that we need. So we opted to be at the Nashville Farmers Market, which we like a great deal. And so our people come and pick up their CSA shares at the farmers market. Now, what is a share? In our case, a share is a portion of vegetables that is the seasonal, what can be seasonally produced on our farm. And this is where it gets interesting, I think, for the consumers, because you may not be aware in your normal buying habits what types of things are available in spring, you know, such as strawberries, mint, radishes, green onions, snow peas. Those are all your spring foods. And then as the weather warms up, it changes. Those lettuces and things are harder to grow, and so you get into the green beans, squashes, tomatoes, eggplants, cucumbers, peppers, all that warm weather stuff. And then fall comes, and so you have, I think that's in sometimes the best part of the season, because summer is tailing off and you still have all these tomatoes and peppers and eggplants, but it's cooling off, and so some of your greens are coming in again. So you have this resurgence of lettuce, spinach, radishes, all your cooler weather things. And so that's sort of the excitement, I think, for the consumer, is you have to be accustomed to accepting what a particular farm can produce, or groups of farms. Some CSAs are groups of farms in order to offer a wider variety of foods. Whereas, you know, it's not for everyone. My mother, for example, eats broccoli every day of the year. So she could certainly participate in a CSA for some of the season, but she's, you know, she wants to eat broccoli, and that's fine. so she's halfway satisfied with us. But the really, I mean, the satisfying thing about CSA for the farmers, for the producers, is we have a career. Like, Robin and I wanted to get into farming, which is difficult nowadays because land is a big commodity, and it's actually almost impossible to buy land and then pay for it by farming. Farming takes an incredible amount of investment and time to get a farm off the ground, and so there's not an equation where you can buy a property and start farming and make your payments, or at least it's difficult to do that the way land prices are. But Rob and I, just by being really careful about debt, we bought an abandoned farm in Kentucky with very small amount of usable acres. It was a 60-acre farm with probably 4 acres that were usable. The rest of it is hills and trees. But again, when you're giving vegetables to at sort of retail prices to consumers, then you're making a lot of money per acre. You're making more, you know, per acre than, let's say, wheat farms. I think the average, and again, I'll apologize for any inaccuracies. I'd like to be able to make some generalizations. I mean, I think wheat, people who grow wheat can expect to make $100 or $200 profit per acre. So if you're a wheat farmer, you need thousands of acres to make any money. Okay, and so I think we're, by operating, again, with direct sales, we're making $5,000 to $7,000 an acre. So to make a living, we only need to operate 5 or 6 acres. And so that's a nice use of the land. We've taken marginal land and made it into sort of a thriving business. And that's the other exciting thing. I mean, we're just grateful to have this career in farming. I just looked up a few details, but in 1910, farmers were 31% of the workforce. By 1990, farmers were only 3% of the workforce. And so that reflects the efficiency and what modern equipment can do. Is for a while, there was this trend for farmers to get bigger and bigger and bigger. which makes sense if you look at solely on efficiency. But then that's less opportunities for people who feel called to do land stewardship or animal husbandry or people who just want to work with my hands. I really like working. Our farm is not heavily mechanized. We rely on volunteers, and we also have a farmer training program. So that's how we overcome some of the massive labor needs that you have on farms. And then another thing with the CSA allows us, pardon me, I need a drink of water.
Oh, getting close.
I'm getting close.
You're getting close.
Okay, that went quickly. Well, I guess I'll just quickly go to accountability then. What probably a good thing about having a direct relationship with a farmer is this whole spinach issue that occurred last spring. That was a terrifying situation where bagged spinach contained E. coli. And I read about this all I could, and I don't think there was ever a satisfactory answer was provided of what happened. And you almost can't get an answer for that kind of thing when you have a variety of farms all send spinach to a central location. They're all mixing it in, they're washing it together, they're bagging it, and then it goes out. And it turns out some of those bags contained E. coli. So you have to throw away millions of bags, and people get sick. My point is, I grew our spinach, and I picked it, and I gave it to you. So if there's a problem, it could probably be traced pretty quickly and pretty accurately. So I'd say that's sort of one of your benefits of dealing directly with your farmer. And then our farm...
You also eat it, too.
Yes, oh, yeah, believe me, when that happened, I was eating spinach every day, just because... I wanted to make sure that I would go down first and not one of our clients. I am out of time, but just as a consumer then, too, our farm is open to all our members. I mean, it's open to anyone we know, but people often bring their kids up to the farm for the weekend or during the week, and so that's another benefit that the consumer has in a relationship with a farm is you have this neat place to go. And our farm is really neat, and you can dig potatoes, or you can investigate some of your interests about farming or nature. I guess since my time's up, I'm looking forward to the question and answer period. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. I'm certainly glad to know that you're going to be throwing yourself in the front of the bus for all of us. Let me see. I think I saw the Delvins come in. I'm sure they're the same. They would be throwing themselves in front of the bus too, right? Right?
Well, yeah.
That's the kind of farmers we have here in Tennessee. They're willing to, you know, throw themselves in front of the bus for all of you. Anyway, we're not going to ask Will to throw himself in front of the bus, but Will Olhorn is executive chef at F. Scott's, and he's going to kind of change pace a little bit. So here's Will.
Hi. First off, I feel very lucky to be even speaking to all of y'all. You know, I don't grow anything. All I do is get to profit from all of the hard work that all of these farmers do and giving us this great stuff that we can use. That being said, it is relatively easy to do, and I really know why a lot more restaurants don't do it. You know, we're given the option of stuff that is grown, you know, mass mechanized and you know, not really tasting all that great, or cultivating a relationship with all of, you know, these friendly people around our area that can bring us this wonderful food that makes us as chefs look 100 times better. So that's a no-brainer. It's really easy. Let's see. And cost-wise, I think for restaurants, there's really not much of a difference. It's you don't have to pay to have it shipped in. You don't have to pay, you know, the 1,500 miles of transit trucks and all of that stuff. And you, like I said, you know, you've always got a great product. For me, one of the great things about the restaurant business and educating the young cooks too is to get a Sysco or one of the produce companies that buys their product from California and get a tomato, for example, and get the young cooks and line them up and let them taste a tomato that's grown by one of the groups of farmers that we buy from next to a Cisco tomato. And, you know, they're step away. They can't believe tasting them side by side what a huge difference it is. And then when we can pass that on to the customers and by doing the right thing and buying from Nancy or whoever we're buying from, give them a far superior product. It's a benefit for everybody, the farmer, the restaurant, and the customer. Like I said, it makes us look great, and all we do is sit back and rely on the work of the local farmers that we're involved with. One thing I think that has made our relationship with the farmers successful is that we buy everything that they can possibly produce. If they come to us and we're like, well, that tomato, and I want this tomato, and I want this, but I don't want this, and this, I think it's really irresponsible on our part. I think it's our responsibility as chefs and as consumers to use everything that they can possibly provide for us and really realize how lucky we are to have such a great product. And it becomes upon us to find what to do with it and to unwrap it and find the best potential for all of the locally grown produce that we can get a hold of. And I think one of the other things that's great is a lot of farmers will come and say, what can we grow for you? You know, what are you looking for this season? And, you know, definitely Cisco's not going to say, what can we grow for you this year? What can we provide you with for this season? And you sort of start to develop a relationship with the farmers, and they know what you're looking for, and you know what they have, and that's great. Let's see, what else was I going to talk about? I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank here. I had some.
Do you buy, you say, from a multitude or several different growers?
We probably buy from about 6 different farmers. Some a lot more than others. I think, you develop a relationship and you buy everything they have, and you treat it as reverently as you possibly can, and I think you do good by everybody by doing that.
And I suspect you buy seasonally.
Oh yeah, we totally do. We change our menu 4 times a year, and we really let the farmers dictate what we're going to put on the menu. To me, it's embarrassing to have something that's out of season on the menu, really.
You know of other restaurateurs around?
Oh yeah, definitely. Jeremy Barlow at Taste. He's very into it. I probably shouldn't name who's into it and who's not into it.
We know who they are.
Yeah, we know who they are. So that's really what I wanted to say. And I can answer questions in a minute. I didn't go my full time. Sorry.
No problem.
Thank you, Will. Appreciate it. Now we have Tallahassee May to talk to us about her experiences in this field.
I didn't bring a PowerPoint, which I'm glad nobody else did either. I do have a computer. I have been known to use it, but I haven't reached PowerPoint status yet. So I have notes, and I'll get going. I might ask Laura to write something. But my name is Tallahassee May. I've been farming in the area 5 years. Grew up in Brentwood, moved away, moved back. My family's all here, and I'm very glad to be here and feel very thankful to be able to be farming here. I have a business with another local farmer named Fresh Harvest Cooperative, which is similar to a CSA model, a little bit different. I'll get to that at the kind of as I go along, how it works. I guess the main thing that I was thinking about in terms of alternative and the word healthy and all this food security talk, I really been thinking about the word sustainability a lot. And what that means to my farm. And I think that's really what we're all talking about when we're here is sustainability. Sustainable communities, sustainable bodies, sustainable for the environment. And what I have been trying to do with my little postage, I mean, I cultivate 3 acres, which is tiny. Works for me because it's just me. And but how do I make it sustainable? And is it sustainable? What does that really mean? So what I have, what I wanted to just go over is kind of my farm story, a little bit of trying to be a sustainable farm, which is extremely hard. So I'll start at the beginning. The first part of sustainability is environmental sustainability. And for me, the bottom line with my farm is I use organic practices only. I mean, that's the bottom line. For me, there's no question there with when you have environmental sustainability in a farm. So I'm not even going to go into that very much. I'm not certified organic. I do a different certification process called certified naturally grown. And what that is it's kind of a grassroots farmer-based network of farmers relying on other farmers for support in doing organic practices. It's the same standards as the USDA organic, but it's not through any government organization, which is my personal choice. But the other environmental sustainability part is just being self-reliant. I like growing my own food. I eat seasonally, except for like on Valentine's Day, my little boy really wanted asparagus. And I don't know where it came from. It's the first time in a long time. I just thought, okay, I'm just putting it in the bag. But other than that, we try to be as self-reliant as possible with our food. And the other thing, environmental sustainability, is our farm practice. And this is where it's really hard. I have a tractor. I wish I had two. I have a tiller. I have a weed eater. I have a lawnmower. We have a chainsaw. I think we have a little mantis thing that it's not really a tiller, but so I use a lot of petroleum, basically. I also have propane heat in my greenhouse. That to me is not sustainable, but I need it. So what am I? That's a big question for me right now. Is where am I going with that? I would like to be looking into biodiesel and things like that. And if I can get a new tractor, that's what I would. That would be my way that I would go. I use my propane as little as possible, and you know. So there's that's. I'm just throwing it out there. This is questions that I have about calling myself a sustainable farmer. Other thing is water conservation. I think we all know that we're entering into this new era of our environment and greenhouse warming, global warming, and what that means to our precipitation in the southeast and how we use our water. Pollinator conservation. We're working a lot with, on my farm, of getting bees, trying to do less mowing, trying to restore habitat so that we're farmscaping, you know, instead of landscaping, trying to make it so that we're just a more of a ecosystem instead of a mowed and cultivated field. And then also another big one is local sources and tools and inputs that we have on our farm. How am I not running to Lowe's every day, you know, and getting a bunch of screws or getting more extension cords, or what else do I need? Oh, chargers for the batteries, because you go and to jump a battery and we can't find our charger. I don't know. So we got to go to Lowe's again. And how do we get away from that? And also inputs. How am I not always trucking in inputs, especially organic inputs, from places like Pennsylvania or North Carolina, or, I mean, not no offense against Pennsylvania, but it's far away from where I am, and I would like to be able to be more sustainable. But I don't want to be buying my feed from Tractor Supply for my chickens because that's GMO feed. So instead of being able to run to a local, even though Tractor Supply is owned by Monsanto, so that's not really local, but the food co-op, how it's all kind of similar there. What am I doing? Am I trucking in organic feed from North Carolina, or am I buying from a local distributor? It's a lot of questions, I guess. And so when we think about our local food system and buying from a local farmer, yes, I mean, of course, that's the way to go. There's no question, but there's also more work to be done about really what a local food system means, I think. Moving on from that, the other part of sustainability is my personal physical sustainability, which is just a little thing of I'm a mom and I started farming with my one-year-old and just kind of did what I could to get going and starting selling at the farmer's market and what can I produce? Okay, here's my little bucket of tomatoes, but I have this one-year-old, see, and he ate them all or, you know, whatever, and didn't make much money that year. But since then, I've been able to grow and figure out how to balance work and play, which is really important, which I know we all try to do. Enjoying the process, because money obviously isn't the main goal of farming. So how do I just keep loving this work, which I'm so thankful to be able to do? And also the idea of teaching. And I know Paul and Robin are really good at this, of having interns and teaching the next generation of farmers. I mean, I like to work by myself, and it's hard for me to realize, you know what, this is important work that we're doing. This is, we need to be teaching so that people carry on this tradition and learn from, like, in a few years, I'm going to be an old-timer, and that's something that I have to get used to and figure out how to pass along. I guess at some point I'll know something to pass along, hopefully. And also enjoying the benefits. I went to a conference and this farmer said, always, what did he, I don't remember the exact words, but it was so life-changing for me. He said, reap the benefits of what you sow. Save yourself the best produce. Which I was like, really? You know, we would, after all day of working in the field, I'll come home and I'll be like, Mexican restaurant, who's going to the Mexican restaurant? You know, who, here's my wilty flowers that didn't sell and that's what I have on the table. So I'm slowly learning to, like, when I have a really nice carrot, it's not only the three-pronged, you know, hairy ones juice with. So that's another benefit that I'm, in terms of sustainability, trying to enjoy what I do. And the last one, I don't know how much time I have left.
A few minutes.
Okay. Is financial. Have to be financially viable to have a farm. It's a job. It's a business. And this was a really big realization for me. It's easy to take lightly, but if I can't make a living doing it, I can't do it. That's the bottom line. I waitressed for years in the off-season. And that really kind of stunk. I really didn't want to be waitressing. But I did it because I wanted to farm. I'm finally to the point where I don't have to do that. But it's the reality is my farm has to be financially viable. My husband works off the farm. He's also self-employed. So it's not like that's necessarily the answer, is that he works off the farm. But it has to be financially viable. And that leads to kind of what my business model is that I am small, and Paul talked about this, is that for a small farmer, you have to really have the direct link to the customer. Can't do the third-party wholesale. I'm just not in the position to do that. So what I need to really cultivate is that direct relationship with the consumer. I get the best price that way. And also I need the high-end product. For me, that means I've really worked a lot with growing flowers because I can get more money per acreage if I do flowers and lettuces and heirloom crops. And that's what my focus is. Also, a few years ago, I started Fresh Harvest Cooperative with another local farmer who was in a similar position, small farm. We grew basically the same stuff, the same methods, and we were neighbors. We worked a lot together. It was like, why are we competing? Why don't we join together? So now we market cooperatively. Our farming situation is pretty much separate, but we put our stuff together, we share our customers, and we offer our customers, you know, what we are able to pull together. That way we could reach more people. We have insurance in terms of crop insurance. If one of us, this is my arugula, looks terrible, and hopefully he'll have some arugula or something like that, that we're able to be really consistent that way. And if I were doing a CSA myself where I was having, you know, I could probably do 30 boxes a week, but with Fresh Harvest, we can access it to where we have 150 people a week between the two of us. So it really grows me as a business working cooperatively with another farmer. And it's also more sustainable for me. I mean, it helps a lot, and it helps both of us a lot. What Fresh Harvest is we call it a subscription service, where we sent out an email once a week. Basically, you subscribe to our email list. And we have a huge email list because people are always signing up. So I think we have quite a few hundred people, which nobody, well, most of them don't order. But at some point, we have to go through and clean that out. But you get our emails once a week that lists what we have available. From that, you place your order, what you want, the quantities that you want. We harvest everything and pack it to order and deliver it on Wednesday. We send out the email Sunday. You have to order by Tuesday. You get it on Wednesday. Everything we do is pick to order and pack to order. And it's basically like going to the grocery store, except you're ordering directly from the farmer. And again, it's that connection with where your food is coming from and that accountability, which is so important these days, that there's no question as to what's happening with your food there. Refer to my notes. I guess my point with all that is that just the idea that the idea of, you know, our food system is so complex, and the best that you can be doing when you're buying locally and knowing who, where your food is coming from, you know, that's the bottom line. But there's a lot more gray area and compromises within that, of course. That's the point, is it's complex. But thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Tallahassee. Okay, now the time you've all been waiting for. First, I have a question. How many farmers do we have here? Pretty good number. How many community activists do we have? A few.
How about gardeners? Do gardeners count?
Okay, gardeners? Number of gardeners, good. How many people do we have here that eat? Glad to see that. Okay. Questions. Who's got some good questions for these people? Go ahead.
I'd like to know her email address.
I'm in the middle of redoing the website, but you can go to www.freshharvest.locallygrown.net.
That's too long.
I know.
Okay, Lori, thank you for writing that. We'll check with you in a few minutes. Question over here?
I have a kind of a two-pronged question for Paul and Tallahassee. Number one, first part of the question is, how close are you to Nashville? And the second question is, how many of your customers are, say, within 10 to 20 miles of your farm? Hmm.
Who's it going to?
Okay, Tallahassee, you want to lead off with that one?
Yeah, I live in, do I need to repeat the question? Where my farm is located and where our customer base is, yeah. I guess, and if anybody is near our farm. I live in Bon Aqua, which is not really a town, but it's outside of Fairview, about 40 minutes outside of Green Hills. I deliver in Green Hills. My customers for Fresh Harvest, pretty much all live in Green Hills area or Nashville area. I don't really have any local people around me because they all have their own gardens.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, Paul? And
we're in a similar situation of in Metcalf County, Kentucky. That's a very rural area, so most local people are taking care of their own needs. Our farm is 2 hours from Nashville, and so we come to the market, which then makes it, I'd say, within 20 minutes for all of our clients. But our farm is 2 hours outside the city.
So you market at the farmer's market? In
yes,
Nashville.
That's where they would pick up their shares.
Yes. We like it because people come down and, you know, they get what they need from Paul and Robin. And since they have not learned how to grow pineapple yet, they can import pineapple and come into the market by that there. And Paul, your customer is pretty much from quite a wide range of areas in Nashville, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, I live in Hillsborough Village, and I know I see a lot of my neighbors down there.
East Nashville. I mean, go ahead, Robin. I don't know the neighborhoods of Nashville that well.
The Hill and Hollow shareholder? Right.
Yeah, I'd say they're from all, I mean, the farmer's market is a convenient location for people from the west side and the east side of Nashville.
You're so good. Do you have a question, or go ahead.
Yes. I'd like to ask all the panelists, from your perspective in the trenches, you have different places that you come from, what are the kinds of things you'd like to see starting to happen in the community that will start pushing the kinds of things that you are already doing to a broader reach? Not that you need to expand yours, but to get more people involved. What would you like to see?
I'm not going to repeat that question.
No,
you'll know what it is, right?
What would the farmers like to see in the community?
Each of the, mm-hmm. What are the next things that you'd like to see start happening to?
Well, I mean, I would say more of the same. As far as interest, we're full this year. Okay, we have a really high retention rate for our members, and so, but we are asked all the time, "Can I join? Can I join?" So there's obviously more interest than the 18 plus CSA type farms that are serving Nashville. So I think it seems like the community is turned on to this type of relationship, and so I would just say more farmers, encouraging people to undertake these kinds of operations if they can.
Yeah, I would add to that the consumers are definitely there, and the issue is more farmers and meeting that demand and keeping people's interest, so that, you know, a few years from now people are like, oh yeah, that local food thing, it didn't work, you know. That we need more farmers to meet this desire, and one way to do that might be things like infrastructure, like fostering internship programs, so that young people are coming in and learning from the farmers that are here and going out and starting their own farms, or like with the land trust, connecting wannabe farmers to land to farm. And also, one thing that I would really love is plastic recycling for drip tape and greenhouse things. We need a lot more recycling.
Recycling of
farm plastic.
Will,
recycling.
You have any comments?
I definitely agree with the recycling thing. From the restaurant point of view, it's impossible for us to recycle all the wine bottles and the beer bottles and all of that kind of stuff. Well, not impossible, but not. It would be very hard for us to do that, and so unfortunately, we end up throwing a lot of that stuff away. And on the one hand, I would say I would like for a lot more restaurants to be using farmed local stuff, but on the other hand, I don't want a lot more restaurants to use it, because there's not that many farmers out there, and we want them all for ourselves. So.
What I find interesting, comment, Tallahassee, how much acreage do you have growing between your two farms?
I do 3 acres. I'm not quite sure how much my partner John cultivates, but it's similar. It's a similar amount. So there's probably about, I would say, 6 to 10 between
them. So it's like 6 to 10 acres, and there's serving 150 families?
And we do the farmer's market as well.
Farmer's market. And Paul, you've got?
I'd say 5 in vegetable cultivation.
Mm-hmm. You have, would you say 75?
75.
I just find it interesting how small acreage it really takes to feed that many people, which I think is great. Maybe that some of that stuff will get out to people, and people will be interested in, you know, getting a farm, that it's a small farm, realizing how many people they can feed. Okay?
There is a figure out there that if managed in sort of biointensively or whatever, your acreage, you can feed 20 families, not their grains, but their vegetable needs on 1 acre. That, I don't know if that's true, but that's kind of out there, that number.
At least directly to my question, if I may, which is how small is too small? How big do you have to be?
What do you want
to be efficient?
Yeah.
As a CSA.
I think it is depend. You have to start with how much you need to make, how much money you need to make, and then and work from there. And one thing is, if you wanted to start and you had an acre, go to the farmer's market and take your produce to a farmer's market and see how much money you make when you bring, you know, if you're bringing 20 pounds of zucchini, it might feel like you're bringing a lot of zucchini, but that's really,
you can go pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's $40.
Okay.
My question is probably more for you and Will, although I'd be interested in Paul and Tallahassee's perspective. And that's kind of like, our family's been trying to do the 250-mile radius for a long time, and we see some voids in the Middle Tennessee market with things that are available. But I'm really curious on your perspectives. Where are the voids? There are a lot of the CSAs that are doing produce. We found a lot of meat, but where are the voids?
Okay. Kim was asking, where are the voids kind of in the marketplace as to what the customer really needs? What's lacking?
As far as the 250-mile radius thing, it seems like there's a lot of things that we can't get from farmers and that we can't get at the farmer's market as well as a customer at the farmer's market. But I think that has a lot to do with what can be grown, and these guys know more about that than me. But lemons, limes, olives for olive oil, that kind of thing, just...
Like I can't find butter or grains. I don't know about other things, but I'm just kind of curious about that. I mean, I realize tropicals I'm not going to get, but do you know what I mean? Like, to get the local grains...
I don't think there's a lot of grain being produced out there for local usage. And I know there's not a single chicken processor in Tennessee, is what I understand, that people are going to Kentucky to have chickens processed, which make no sense at all.
May I comment there?
Who wants to go into that job, though? Is there any, I want to process chicken by
now. This is sort of an issue for your, legislators and activists, is that you're not allowed to sell dairy products off the farm legally. So that limits, everyone, let's say I'll speak for four peer CSAs that I have intimate knowledge of. All of us have cows. All of us milk cows. And all of us produce butter seasonally, which we don't dare bring to market. You can't do that sort of thing without taking serious risk with your farm. You can be put out of business quickly for that type of activity. So there is legislation needs to be adjusted so that local producers can sell more of their farm products legally.
Is that because it's not pasteurized? Or
I don't know the reasons. I won't answer.
Isn't it true, though, that if you own a share of a animal, for instance, you can get its byproduct?
Yes, there are methods where you can sort of work around that, but they, I think, have not so far held up in court. There are many programs.
It really depends on what court will hear that case, and they're coming to court with those cases.
And then you can't, when you put this much investment in a farm, we don't want to take that kind of risk because you could be shut down.
Is that a safety issue? Is that what it's?
I suppose, just like money, like everything else.
I don't think it's really.
We eat our own butter constantly.
I have seen a place, and I won't mention any, where they sell milk for pet use.
Right.
And I won't tell you where. Let's get some new people.
It's conveniently located down.
You mentioned that your ability to supply is. Can't keep up with demand that you have. And then I was just wondering, what obstacles are there to farmers, legal or others, that are preventing people from doing what y'all are doing and increasing the supply for customers?
So you're looking at what kind of obstacles a prospective farmer would have getting into the business?
Okay, because we have an apprentice program, I know of three persons that have come through our program and are seeking a career in farming. I'd say land accessibility. It's just hard when it's really difficult to buy, for one, small parcels of land. The price is huge for a small amount of land. But then when you get up into your bargain areas of 100, 200, 300 acres, where it's reasonably priced per acre, that is also a huge sum. And so from my limited knowledge, it's young people are wanting to buy land or even lease it in a secure way. And that seems to be one of the biggest hurdles, is where do I start? Because another thing is, farming is so difficult, and it takes time to build up fertility. It takes time to get your growing systems in order. So if you have a short-term lease, 2-3 years, it's terrifying to have the idea of that yanked out from under you. Someone changes their mind and says, well, I don't want you here anymore, then you've lost an incredible amount of your effort and your labor have gone into maybe bringing the fertility up on a space that you can lose on a whim. So I'd say land access is a big hurdle.
Do you have any?
I would definitely second that, and also, and just the money to put into your infrastructure can be overwhelming. And of course, there's ways to do it slowly, and where you're really investing your time, and where you don't need as much money. But like Paul said, that can really go on. And if you really, for people that really want to get into farming and start having it be financially viable, I think money has been my huge issue in terms of needing to put money into the farm for infrastructure, and where is that money coming from without going into debt, and I don't know where that, you know, a lot of it is, luckily my husband and I are very handy and we do a lot of our electrical and things ourselves, but if for somebody that's really just starting out, it's so huge, it would be nice if there was more of a support system for that.
Okay. I think there's another question. Go ahead.
My question first came up when I heard Paul, you spoke using only 4 acres of many times that the farm, and also Tallahassee's joke of developing kind of an ecosystem rather than just a, you know, cleared out farm. Also, if you look into permaculture, or if you utilize your other acres for forest for farming.
When I was in college, I loved permaculture.
Okay, the question is, what do you do with the rest of your acreage?
Yeah.
We grow shiitake mushrooms. That's one use of forest lands. Part of our interest also is in land stewardship. So a lot of our acres we're kind of leaving be to let nature manage. Which is where we don't have a pollinator problem. Mm-hmm. Because we have so many acres of forest, we have all kinds of various bees that are, you know, helping the farm. Permaculture, I'm fascinated by it, but our money comes from annual vegetable production, and so it's really hard to either risk areas to try permaculture when your income, because we're paying for our land still, you don't want to break in your income. And so we're kind of very focused on maintaining our annual vegetable production as we try to expand other schemes, like, you know, fruit trees, raspberry bushes. But our logs, we grow shiitake mushrooms. I'd say that's our one direct usage of the forest besides recreation and beauty.
And for me, my farm is kind of, I have a friend that calls it, instead of rural, it's kind of sur-rural. It's suburban rural, where, you know, I have a lot of, my acres was a flat yard, basically, and a horse field. It's a lot of horse farms, so it's a lot of open grass, pasture, and hay. And we sometimes mow, and we're trying to mow less. And what we're trying to do with the pollinator conservation is convert that grass into a field where we're not mowing, and we're trying to integrate berries and things like apple guilds with apple trees and fruit trees into that field area. So there are some permaculture principles that I'm trying to apply on our plot. I don't integrate permaculture into my actual production area because it's not efficient. For me personally, and I really always, because it's me or one other person, I have to be as efficient as possible all the time. And so I don't use permaculture in the field, but in other aspects I try to.
Can you give what permaculture is? I'm sure a lot of people are not.
You might be able to better than
somebody. So everyone knows what everyone's talking about.
Generally, it's just a sustainable model for growing things that incorporates the natural ecosystem. Like Paul was saying, you have pollinators that are naturally available to flowers and various things, rather than trying to clear a plot of land and then do us.
Okay, thank you. Gentleman, right there.
Yeah, in hearing about your experiences with the CSA, it seems like lower income urban families, let's say, maybe without internet access, it seems like that's a group that could be left out from the availability of things like this. Do you have any suggestions or thoughts on how that could be improved?
What that is one thing this food security group is looking at is, you know, how do we supply individuals that live in an area where we'll call a food desert, where they, as I said, mentioned earlier, you know, within a 1 mile radius, they have more stores selling cigarettes and alcohol than they do fresh vegetables. So we're looking at ways to do that. One with the Boys and Girls Club farmers market, and Nashville as a whole is looking at that concept and seeing what else we can do. So we're very active in trying to figure out how to do that. And we may do other farmers markets in remote areas, working with MDHA right now in some of their housing projects and putting a small farmers market there like one time a week. So we're looking at different things like that. We also work with Sean Seipel with Good Food for Good People at the farmers market, and they do gleaning. So they come in and they work with our vendors. And if a peach has got a small bruise in it and they can't sell it retail-wise, they give it to Sean. If it's still good enough, he will take it out to halfway houses or homes for the elderly and give it away. If it's too far gone, then we he takes it to compost. So some of the things that are going on. Okay, Paul, I think you were interrupting
you. I just wanted to comment that we one of the reasons we were at the farmers market is we thought we'd be able to meet a wide range of people. Perhaps one of the blockages to lower income people is the upfront share price. But we, our system is arranged that if anyone explains their situation, we can make any kind of adjustment necessary. But that certainly is one of our concerns, is probably people who need fresh food the most aren't getting it. We do donate a share every season to someone that's sort of nominated or suggested by our members. I mean, that's, of course, a tiny drop in the bucket. But we think about that often, of how to get more of this food to people. And we're open to ideas and suggestions, too.
Okay. What are you two back there? Arm wrestle for it.
How does the CSA or subscription or restaurant, for that matter, deal with, like we had this year with the freeze and the drought? So you've got people that have resubscribed. How do you work around that or make adjustments for it? Was that an issue?
Right. Well, in our system, in the CSA system, you're agreeing to take the risk with us. So whatever happens, happens. I mean, that's part of the protection for the farmers in that system. Okay. And so let's say this year there may be a lack of any certain number of vegetables or a lack of volume. That's the ebb and flow of nature. I think our people trust that we're farming as best we can. And so when there's lacks of things, that's sort of the system. Now, on the other side of that, the way our CSA works is when there's a bumper crop of things, like let's say we distribute a pound of beans a week to people, and they really start coming on, and we have bins where people can help themselves, okay? You could take 5 pounds. The CSA price doesn't go up on that time. So there's an ebb and flow that we encourage people to sort of look at, don't look at each week, but look at the whole season, and that's sort of the bounty of our system. But that is a protection. There's no refunds. You're agreeing to go in with us on what happens.
The question was, you know, how does the ebb and flow of weather really affect your production and how that affects the consumer? And it's a great protection for the farmer because, I mean, think of what they're risking. You know, if they have a severe drought and they are not doing a CSA, I mean, they could be out of business. And we've lost another farmer. So a CSA is just a great way to go.
My model is a little bit different in that it's not a CSA in that I don't have people buying into a share of my farm. So, and especially the money isn't there ahead of time. It's so it is more of just what I can provide, I can sell. I don't have an insurance kind of like a CSA does. It's for me, it was a hard year for sure. I'm diversified so that I have a variety of crops. I'm not dependent on, like for instance, in August, I let my flowers go because my well was getting low, and I decided the food aspect of the situation of the farm was more important to me than the flowers. Even though the flowers are good money and people really love them, I really wanted to make sure that I had food into the fall. So I let the flowers go and concentrate on the food and stop trying to fight. In August, it was a fight all the way around. And it gets to be like, yeah, is this sustainable? What am I fighting here? That was a choice. And I don't know where that's going to lead in the future in terms of climate change and things. But again, being diversified helps because there's income from more than one source coming in, and you're not dependent on only one crop to bring in that income.
Young lady back here.
Could I comment just further on that? Is the other side of that is when you're patronizing sustainable producers, soil building, we spend a lot of our time obsessing about making compost, plowing in cover crops, using mulches to make the farm is more resilient to drought when you're in a sustainable type of practice. So that's where we sort of invest our time and our effort. And we're very appreciative when the shareholders let us flow through that way. But it works out in the end. Our year came out okay in the end. It was stressful. Yeah. It was extremely stressful. But people expressed satisfaction by the end of the year.
Okay, I think we have time for two more questions.
My question is for Will. You were talking about how buying locally from farmers is a no-brainer, right? And I've worked in the restaurant business all my life, and I'm very familiar with the gigantic Sysco machine. And I was wondering, from your perspective, if it's so easy, you know, to do this, to change your ways and buy from local farmers, why don't more chefs do that? And what do you think would have to happen for that to change?
I think there would have to be more product available. We do have to supplement what we buy from farmers, definitely with things we buy from Sysco and the local produce companies. We try to buy more from the local produce company than we do from Sysco, but a lot of it does come from California and Florida. But I think that there just has to be more farmers and more products available for people to buy and more interest. A lot of people just aren't interested and going out and pursuing the relationship with the farmers. And that's probably, you know, the places you're going to be less, or all of us are less likely going to be eating. But more farmers, I think, is the main thing.
So maybe is there also an element of, I know the supply and demand is definitely an issue, but is there also an element of education that could be brought up around the teaching of chefs and the training of chefs?
I think so. And I think the more training a chef has, the more interested he is going to be in buying local and things like that. And I know several of us are kind of working on ways or clubs or something, or some kind of an association of chefs, to where we could get together and talk about what we're doing and talk about what farmers we're able to buy from, and passing that kind of information along as well. And hopefully, you know, by the end of this year, we can get it together and have something like that in place.
We did a Farm Chef program a couple months ago, which was found very interesting, and it's really an interesting dynamic between the farmers and the chefs. Mm-hmm. You know, again, if they're having weather problems or something and they can't provide something, then the chef can't get it. It's, you know, he's kind of promised it on his menu, so what does he do? He has to supplement, or then they have too much coming in, and then he usually doesn't know how many people are going to come in the front door and how many people are going to ask for, you know, a tomato soup that night or whatever. So, I mean, it's really an interesting dynamic between the two groups. But I think he's right. I think we need to support more local chefs, because the local chefs, locally owned restaurants, are the ones that have a higher tendency to buy from the local farmers. So we need to remember that, and I won't mention any names of any restaurants, but, you know, take go to the restaurants that are local. They're locally owned and locally, you know, manned, because those are the best ones. They have the best product. So,
not your local Chili's.
Locally
that's
owned.
That's the new thing. We're local chefs. We're right here in your town.
Yeah. They're all trying to do the local thing, but okay.
Yeah. I just did a little math based on what y'all said about how many people you feed and how many acres you have. And if, according to what you're saying, it would take about 4,000 farmers doing CSAs to feed the roughly million people in Nashville with local produce, which would involve about 20,000 to 24,000 acres of farming, and the local farming in this area. I was wondering if anybody had any ideas on how to get from here, which is 17 CSAs, to there, which is like 4,000 local vegetable producers.
Well, there's also one thing I left out is that we also sell at the Franklin Farmers Market on Saturdays. So there's the CSA model of one way, but then I also need another distribution. I need to do at least two times a week. So I have a whole other customer base in Franklin on Saturdays. So that's perhaps that many more people that are being fed through farmers markets or through other kind of local farm stands that aren't being reached, you know, only in the CSA or direct, you know, that kind of.
I think farmers need to diversify their crops, but also their customers.
So you have
to have that range of customers. You know, Portland, Oregon is one city that has zoning. So the core of their city is like within, I can't remember, it's a 25-mile radius. And that's where all the intensive development is. Beyond that is more rural. So we need to look at, you know, the whole development of Middle Tennessee and, you know, what do we want? I mean, I don't know how many acres are being developed with subdivisions growing faster than crops these days. You know, Bell's Bend area is one. They just announced a huge, you know, development out there. But that's also a lot of, you know, farmland out there. So, you know, what do we do? So what's important to us? And, you know, how are we going to control that in the future? So I think we're out of time. I've got 11:50. So I want to thank my panelists. I appreciate them being here. Thank you, all of you, for being here today in this session, and, you know, spread the word. You know, tell people what you learned today, and we'll all be more successful. Thank you.
Good job. I want to say something.